This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we'll continue our discussions with statewide candidates for office in the general election with Zach Racknerud. He's the Democratic NPL candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. He joins us from Minot. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Give us some background. Tell us about Zach Racknerud.
Sure. So I'm Zach Racknerud. I'm a lifelong North Dakotan, 27-year-old working class North Dakotan. I love this state. I love this country. And I entered this race because back in January, I saw what I refer to as a reverse funnel economy. The standard of living of our working and middle class, their bottom lines continue to erode day after day, year after year, decade after decade. The cost of healthcare, childcare, post-secondary education, housing, such basic tenets of life, the costs are rising unsustainably. And meanwhile, Congress has not been reactive to the needs of our working class. And then in March, the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and it really exposed a lot of those flaws. Hundreds of billions of dollars has flowed upward into the hands of very few people. And at the same time, so does political power. So I'm in this race to advocate for common sense economic investments in our working families here in North Dakota that help their bottom lines, because we're facing such a time of crises. I think these things are needed.
Now, you mentioned your age. You're 27. The minimum age to run for the U.S. House of Representatives is 25. The current youngest member is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's almost 31. So you're young at this. How are you sustaining this operation? How are you funding it? How would you gauge your support in terms of the party being behind you?
Yeah, the DemNPL constituency has been incredibly supportive of this campaign. We won the primary election convincingly, and I really do believe that North Dakotans overall understand the urgency of the times we face and the great need for investment in our working families here in the state. And so I'm running a campaign that is completely funded by small dollar donations, and I'm not taking any corporate PAC money. Meanwhile, Congressman Armstrong takes a significant amount of it. And I think that just paints part of the problem that there is in Washington, D.C., and in who dictates the priorities of Congress on a day-to-day basis. And so I'm excited to continue advocating for the working class of North Dakota. And I think that me being young is actually a good opportunity, because the average age of Congress today is completely disconnected from the reality of our population. And the House of Representatives is the perfect spot for a regular working class person to come in and make a difference. It truly is the people's house. Our founders intended for it to be filled with representation of everyday members of the community that understand what constituents are facing, and that's what this campaign represents.
Let's talk about the biggest issue of this campaign, which is national and local and statewide, and that's the pandemic. How would you describe the pandemic response in North Dakota and in the nation, and how do you expect it to affect voters, particularly those who might support you?
Yeah, the pandemic overall has been handled very poorly, especially on an economic foundation, in my mind. We've seen hundreds of billions of dollars flowing up to the top of the economy while tens of millions of people were laid off. Tens of millions of people lost their health care coverage. Small businesses are struggling. The response was completely underwhelming. For the duration of that crisis, we should have had a much broader safety net economically for our people, so we could have not seen the devastation that we're seeing today, particularly in the small business community. I believe strongly we need to advocate for those investments starting now. The two chambers of Congress are completely gridlocked on this, any form of economic relief. And so as the one representative North Dakota gets, that representative needs to be advocating strongly, and making that their number one focus is getting economic relief to our working families. And so that's what we're working to do today.
Well, COVID-19 has seemed to become a political issue. It's even as it's a serious public health issue, and that is that you've got people breaking down along ideological lines about whether to wear a mask or, you know, whether to open up all the bars and restaurants or whatever. So where are you on those kinds of public health issues?
Yeah, when it comes to, like, common square areas, mask usage should be extremely high. We need to really consider a mandate at this point. And the big hang-up with that is the enforcement piece. But when I've gotten feedback from healthcare professionals across the state, I have really gleaned that the mandate itself allows private entities to enforce usage of the mask in their facility without having repercussions when it comes to competition or the like. And when we're talking about places that everybody needs to go to, like the grocery store, the hardware store, convenience stores, it is a very easy thing to simply wear a face covering. And with this being a droplet virus, they are extremely effective at limiting the spread in those areas. Certainly, if somebody makes the choice to go to an eating establishment, you're not going to be able to wear a mask during that. So those areas are where people need to make their choices, and a mandate wouldn't really affect that area of life because you can obviously take off your mask when you're eating or having a drink. And so this is something that would be so simple and would have a great impact to really slowing the spread of the virus, because we look at hospital beds in North Dakota, and a lot of it is staffing issues. And if we don't do something with the winter coming up and regular flu season, I worry greatly about the healthcare system here in North Dakota. So we need to be taking this seriously.
Zach Racknerud is the Democratic NPL candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. He's vying against incumbent Republican Kelly Armstrong, who's going after a second term. Zach, what are your critical differences with Congressman Armstrong?
Yeah, there's plenty of differences. We are very different campaigns, but I would say the biggest to me is subservience and loyalty to a political party. The first term of Congressman Armstrong has not been a whole lot of communication with his constituents. There'll be occasional radio town halls with Scott Hennin. There's maybe twice a year he'll do one through his office. But by and large, his representation is just following the marching orders of the GOP establishment. And I think North Dakota deserves representation that's actually nuanced on the issues. If there's a situation where Joe Biden wins the presidency and I win this seat, I'm going to be out there holding the administration accountable in these incredibly pressing times. And that's not the representation that Kelly Armstrong is giving. He's mostly just amplifying the message of his party's establishment. And that's exactly the representation that we don't need right now. So I'm here to advocate for actual tangible investments in the bottom lines of our working families.
I went up to your website, ZachForND.com or ZachForNorthDakota.com, and came across a list of issues that you're basing your campaign on. And one is to expand Medicare. Let's get into some of these things. How would you go about doing these things?
Yeah, so I believe as a baseline that Medicare should cover everybody. Right now, Medicare and Medicaid cover anybody over 65 and anybody that's at or close to the poverty line when it comes to Medicaid. That's single-payer healthcare, and that is working for those populations. And I believe that we need to take that great program and have it cover everybody. Right now, we pay 1.5% each for employee and employer to fund Medicare. And for it to cover everybody, it would need to be raised to about 4% apiece. But right now, people in North Dakota and across the nation are paying an incredible amount of money for healthcare. And that slight public tax increase would be a gigantic take-home pay increase for our people, and it would give that security that if you ever get sick, if you ever get hurt, if you ever get laid off, if you ever want to start a small business, you'll have Medicare there as a baseline coverage at all times, no matter your current situation in life. And we can certainly have discussions about what the role of private healthcare coverage is, because if you look across the globe, all these countries that have some form of guaranteed health care coverage also have supplemental private health insurance as part of the equation. And so that's the kind of direction we need to go, is guaranteeing that health care coverage no matter your current situation in life, because we have 500,000 American families every year are declaring bankruptcy in part due to medical costs. We have an estimated 42,000 to 69,000 people each year who are dying because they're not able to access adequate preventative care because it would bankrupt them. And so when they eventually go to the emergency room for a situation they can't ignore anymore, it's oftentimes too late, and tragically too late. So the structure of our healthcare system is completely broken. We need to actually be tackling healthcare at the preventative level, and that would save the system incredible sums of money. It would give our people economic security. It would increase entrepreneurship, and I'm happy to advocate for it as strongly as I can.
Medicare for All would go a little further than Vice President Joe Biden is proposing in his presidential race. He's talking about providing an expanded public option. But let's move on to another issue here. You also want to expand Social Security. This is something that's been under a bit of a cloud for a long time now. I speak as somebody who gets it, that the Social Security Trust Fund may be in some peril. So how do we expand it and protect the current recipients of it and build it for the future?
Yeah, so there right now, today, for Social Security, there is a taxable income cap that is set at $138,000, which means the bulk of working class people, all working class people and a bulk of middle class people, are paying their contribution into Social Security on every single paycheck for the entire year. Meanwhile, those at the very top of the economy will stop paying a single dime into the Social Security Trust Fund just a few minutes into the fiscal year. And I think that's extremely flawed. I think that the payroll tax cap should be eliminated, and that everybody should have to pay their share into Social Security on each of their checks through the entire year. That would allow us to expand benefits. It would allow us to look at things like paid family leave, maternity and paternity leave, which is something that would be extremely valuable for families starting life together. Having that economic security while being able to spend those crucial first moments in life when a child is born, that would have incredible effects on working families and positivity. And that's the kind of framework that I think we need to have when discussing a lot of these policies, is that the mental well-being of our people in this country is hurting. And it's certain things like that that Congress can make the investments in and really modernize the great program that is Social Security.
Another issue that I got off of your website, zachfornd.com, is a popular one with lots of candidates and lots of races, including at the presidential level with the Democratic candidate, Joe Biden. That is, rebuild the nation's infrastructure, the crumbling infrastructure, as it is sometimes referred to.
Yeah, that I think that with that policy position in particular, both parties will really say that they want to do infrastructure spending, and unfortunately, too often it doesn't get done. The way that I frame it is that we're at a point where we need New Deal scale infrastructure investments in this country. It wasn't since the New Deal era in 1930 through 1950 that we made such significant investments in our domestic infrastructure. And for many decades following, we've really relied on that investment. And so given the state of city and state and local budgets now because of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's clear to me that the federal government needs to play a supporting role in getting key infrastructure projects done. That's how the original New Deal really worked, was that local and city and state governments would identify projects that need to be completed, and they would be given federal funding to take out a portion of the cost of that project. There's a great website called livingnewdeal.org, and if you go to that, you can actually look at all of the New Deal projects that were completed in North Dakota during that time. It's hundreds. My hometown of Northwood, of 1,000 people, the original water system for Northwood was built during the New Deal. And what they did was they applied for that federal funding within the New Deal legislation and were given enough to soak up almost, it was actually a little over half the cost, I believe. And those kinds of investments right now, particularly with the state of the economy and our city and state budgets is something that we need to address.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the cost of campaigning and campaign financing and your emphasis on individual donors and relatively small contributions. You're advocating for publicly financed elections. What benefits would we have from that?
Yeah, so right now, today, the political will of the American people as a whole is not being recognized. There was a 2014 Princeton study that said that the preferences of the average American appear to have a minuscule, near zero, statistically insignificant impact upon public policy. And that's because since the 1970s, the mid-1970s largely, business interests really descended upon Washington, and without shame, after the Powell memo, as it's quoted, tried to access as much public power as possible. And they've been extremely successful at that. Congress is completely operating today at the behest of those at the very top of the economy, and that's where we see their priorities come full bore. What publicly financing our elections would do is a solution that needs to be discussed, and then with that, maybe we can compromise and have more election reform. But what it would do is it would equip every voting-age American with an elections dividend, let's say $20, $50, whatever the amount may be, and they can then contribute that to the candidates of their choice. So then it would allow candidates that are most in tune with the realities that their constituents face to earn that contribution, while working class people don't have to dig into their bottom line in order to help that candidate out. Right now, the crisis we face in campaign finance is so dire that I think we need to be having discussions as big as that in order to get anything real done.
Would this mean that there would still be PACs, but there would be this public financial option as well?
Yes, it would. Really, it's the way that Congress can increase the bargaining power of our working class. But right now, there's so much judicial precedent set when it comes to all the cases that led to Citizens United and such cases overall. That has really made the power disjointed in a big way, and this would be Congress's way of giving some of that power back to the people.
On your website, you also have another issue there that kind of jumps out. You want to end the war on drugs and ban private prisons. Connect these two things.
Yeah, the private prison piece specifically, it's immoral in my sense that we would ever incarcerate somebody for profit. We are incarcerating more people in this country than communist China, even. And this is a problem throughout our system, and the war on drugs has a lot to do with it. Obviously, you know, addiction and the negative that comes with drug use is a horrible thing. But putting the judicial system, the criminal justice system, first and foremost is flawed in the way I see it. We could instead be making investments in mental health care, in rehabilitation services, instead of spending all this money putting people behind bars. And so when it comes to an issue like marijuana, for example, that's something that is relatively more benign than even alcohol, but we're putting people in jail for it. That's not something we should do. We should be legalizing marijuana at the federal level, because it's a freedom issue too. And it's something that is physically impossible to overdose fatally on. It's just an issue that's clear in my mind that we need to stop this war on drugs and to instead invest in the mental and the health well-being of our people.
You referred to this also, paid family leave and affordable child care. That's is under a lot of attention right now, the child care piece, because of COVID-19 and people having to go to work and their kids having to be at home or having to take lessons online, whatever. How do we get to this place, which a lot of countries do have, affordable child care and paid family leave for even months in some cases for either father or mother? How do we get there?
Yeah, it really paints the picture of how disjointed Congress has been with the realities of our working people for the last 50 years. And we really just need to really focus on our down ballot races when it comes to races like this. I would advocate strongly to look at something like a wealth tax. A 2% wealth tax on fortunes that exceed $55 million could be an adequate funding mechanism to make investments in childcare, because right now the approach of mostly letting the market dictate it and just giving tax credits after the fact for these sorts of things is something that's not working. I talked to so many people across this state, and childcare has to be one of the top issues. So many people and young families are paying upwards of $1,000 per month per child, and they have celebrations when their child is old enough to enter the public school system because it's such an incredible impact on their budget. If we look at something like a wealth tax to fund childcare services, that money would be collected by the federal government, but it would be kicked down to state and local governments to be able to make those investments in childcare. It's something that I think we need to do because it is such an incredible crisis we face economically, and it would take care of the well-being of our children. It would put millions of Americans to work in childcare. It's something that would benefit the economy across the board, and it needs to get done.
Why do you think the Democratic NPL party struggles to win statewide offices in North Dakota?
I think a lot of it has to do with the National Democratic Party, the DNC, and really the kind of representation and governance that they've given us. The fact is that both major parties have been complicit in the broken campaign finance structure we see, and their priorities have also been disconnected from working people. And if you look at the heads of the party being people like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, and establishment figures like that that just don't understand the economic pain that's out there. And so not having that strong message has really hurt the Dem MPL here in North Dakota, which has an incredible history and has, not too far long ago was when the Dem MPL was winning those statewide races. But really the anti-Obama wave and the Trump wave really did a big number. And I think it points to a lot of the failures of the DNC.
A lot of the issues you point to and the ways you would deal with them sort of point to the candidacy of former independent who declared as a Democrat, Bernie Sanders. How ardent are you about Joe Biden?
When it comes to Joe Biden or President Trump, I'm pretty ardent about it. I do believe that President Trump has been just a very poor president. He has overseen incredible mass transfers of wealth going to the very top of the economy while putting on a sideshow as president. I don't think that he understands the economic realities that our working people are facing at all. And I believe that, Joe Biden will actually be able to focus on some of those things. He's a candidate that, I wouldn't have picked him in the primary. I'm not ultra excited. He's somebody who has more of that connection to the realities that people face every day. He's made some money off of a book deal, but I mean, even looking at his tax disclosures, he's only bringing in like maybe $1 million a year. Compared to President Trump, who has what looks to be an extremely fraudulent business empire that is relying on incredible losses to shield from tax liabilities, he's just a showman in my mind. And we need to have somebody in there who's actually ready to deal with the economic crises we're facing. And I think Joe Biden would do a far better job.
Zach Racknerud is the Democratic NPL candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. You can find out more about his campaign at ZachForND or ZachForNorthDakota.com. Zach, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater's artistic director joins us to talk about the online 10-minute play festival. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Fargo City Commissioners have shot down two options for a mask mandate on a 3-2 vote. Commissioner John Strand's proposal was to have the measure's first reading of two proposed mandates, one that included a penalty and the other without a penalty, to be held at a meeting in 2 weeks. Strand and Commissioner Arlette Preston voted in favor. Mayor Tim Mahoney and Commissioners Tony Garrig and Dave Pepcorn voted against. The mandate would require people to wear a face covering when they are near people from outside their household where 6 feet of social distancing is not done. Those 10 and under with a medical condition or disability working in jobs where distance can't be maintained would be exempt. Mayor Mahoney said this is a difficult question and warned that when emotions are mixed with decisions, it can be dangerous.
In our transit department, you have to have a mask before you can board a bus. One of our transit workers walked up to somebody, said, put on a mask. As he walked away, he was cold cocked from the back, knocked down. He went to the hospital. Security guard came over, asked the gentleman to put on a mask. Same thing happened to him. We had to call the police in to arrest the gentleman for knocking our people down.
Commissioner Strand says the mandate is something that needs to be in place if the COVID infection rates and positivity rates continue to worsen. He said, quote, it is best to have tools available to act upon if we're called to do that at that point in time. Fargo's new police chief, David Zabolski, says there are no easy answers to this and said enforcement would put the police department in a precarious position. Speaking of the new Fargo police chief, David Zabolski says his officers will have body cameras by late spring or early summer of 2021. Zabolski says he has a team doing analysis of body cams and the department will have demonstrations from 4 vendors over the next month or two. He says these are expensive but necessary items.
We want to make sure that the vendor that we go with can meet all of the check boxes and parameters that we want this equipment to have so that it's viable and usable for the officer, but it also meets the community expectations in terms of, you know, the triggers. That some of this stuff comes with automatic triggers. So if you're under duress, if I pull my gun, I don't have to worry about putting my camera on. As soon as I do that, the camera activates. And so, again, making use of the best technology, that's what we're looking for.
Zabolski replaces Dave Todd, who retired. And one of the GOP-endorsed candidates for the North Dakota House has died. The party says David Ondal passed on Monday. He and Dave Nehring won endorsements in District 8 in both the party's district convention and in the primary. Incumbent Republican Jeff Delzer, who chaired the House Appropriations Committee, was denied the nomination in a district convention and lost in the primary. Ondal was from rural Baldwin. He was a rancher and served on the Burley County Planning Commission. State law apparently does not allow a replacement to be named on the ballot. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Adam Panko. He is the artistic director of the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater. And though the theater itself is physically closed, the artistic efforts of the theater are ongoing. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's talk about your latest venture, the 10-Minute Play Festival that just started last Friday.
Yeah, we have plays that we are doing here in a obviously a different way because of the world that we're in. But we're happy to have some content coming out of our theater and engaging our actors and directors as well. So it's a unique project. I think all of us are learning a whole lot about creating theater in a much different way.
Well, let's talk about the plays. These are obviously short plays. What will we see if we buy a ticket?
So we have, over the course of the next 8 weeks, we actually have 9 plays that are going to be presented. So our goal is to drop 1 play every week. We've got a bonus play that we're going to drop in there someplace at one point or another. But these are all, as you said, short plays, but they're all original plays. So FMCT opened up for submissions, a call for playwrights to submit plays to us. And we got 148 submissions from around the world. We had 3 or 4 from Australia, a few from the UK and Ireland and Canada, and of course, you know, in the United States here as well. But from those 148, we chose what we felt were the best 9 for our very first play festival. So those plays are all going into production. There there's just a slight overlap in rehearsal time between things, but once a week then we are putting up a new play into rehearsal and then also filming a new play as well that will be dropped on a Friday. So we film on Tuesday, we edit and work through sound issues and all those other things in calibrating the video, and then we drop it on Friday. So from now until November 20th, there'll be new plays that we'll release on our website.
So when people buy a ticket and go online to see the show, what do they see? Is it a wide shot of people reading? Is that what it is? Or is it produced beyond that?
It's produced beyond that. So they are, all of these plays are, you know, to kind of use some of the terminology that our schools have been using this year in going back to class, right? Like, we have, you know, distance learning where, you know, everybody's in their own rooms. We have hybrid learning, or then we have like 100% in-person sort of thing. This would be a hybrid project, I would call it. Our plays did rehearse in person and filmed in person, but obviously the audience is the hybrid piece who is watching it from home. So all of our plays were staged with social distancing, 6 feet apart. Some of our plays, you'll see actors wearing masks as well, depending on where, you know, how we could kind of work the filming of it all. But the content then is delivered online every week.
So tell us about the show that was put online last Friday.
Sure. So that is actually a play. Actually, I directed it. But that's one of our two local playwrights that's represented in this festival here. So as I said, we had 148 total submissions, and of those 148, two local playwrights rose to the top. So this is a playwright, a novice playwright. He would even admit to saying that. His name is Jason Cassette. By day, he works as a pharmacy tech, but by evening, I guess, at least this last week, he was living out his playwright fantasies. So it was a play called Let's Make a Deal, was the name of it. And it was basically about an individual who goes to the afterlife and meets St. Peter and has to, you know, kind of reckon with his life on earth versus what his life in the afterlife would be like as well. And when you kind of perceive your work as maybe something else, that others maybe see it as something else, how do you reckon with that piece? So it's interesting. I mean, the way that I described it maybe sounds a little lofty of a subject matter, but in this particular case, it was treated with a lot of wit and kind of just oddball kind of occurrences with it. So it was a fun play to work on and to put up on its feet and kick off our festival.
Now, when you go to a play at the FMCT, when it opens again, typically mm-hmm. there would be lighting and perhaps some music, some sound effects. Is that incorporated into these kinds of productions?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lighting rig and sound stuff. Everybody was recorded using our soundboard. Everybody was wearing a microphone. We shoot with two cameras, so it's an edited final film where you get some wide shots and close-ups and all of that. If there's anything that's a little lighter in terms of needs would be a kind of our tech pieces. Like, there aren't big full sets that we build out for things. But in the case of my play, it did have a small backdrop, and it had some furniture pieces and things like that to make it kind of set the world with it. But we're trying to produce as high quality as we're able to, and we learned a lot this first play, certainly. And so I think as we continue on with plays 2 through 9, there'll be a marked kind of difference in quality as we kind of keep looking at things and revising the way that we're doing things. So this is all new to us, just like it is to anybody else as well. So,
and people who buy the tickets are given a link to Vimeo. That's the online video platform that is pretty much everywhere. What's the show that's coming up this Friday? What's number two?
So this second play, this is a fun play called Hotel Rewards, and it's written by Minneapolis playwright Stephen Murray is his name. This is pure entertainment. Like, there's nothing to take away to go, oh wow, I need to reevaluate my life. This one is all pure comedy for the sake of comedy. So it's about like a hotel rewards, like kind of frequent traveler rewards program at this hotel, and all the things that this hotel does to go above and beyond a normal rewards program. So it's a pretty funny piece. It's very irreverent, but I think it'll be a really fun one that people will enjoy. It's just a two-person cast. All of our plays have a cast either between 2 and 5 individuals. That was part of our rules, actually, for submission. And this play is directed by, actually, a fan favorite on our FMCT stages. Lee Clocky directed this play for us.
And you can find the tickets at fmct.org. How many tickets have you been selling? How popular is this turning out to be?
You know, we were pleasantly surprised. We sold some kind of all-access passes to this festival here. Those are off sale now, although we are going to, I'll let your listeners in on a little secret. We are going to open those sales up again next week for the passes. But right now, people can buy them single tickets. Just go on the website and they can buy a single viewing ticket to see each week's video, or those that bought passes, they will have the opportunity to see all of the plays that we release. So we were really nicely surprised with the number of passes we sold and even the numbers that came in over the weekend for on-demand single ticket sales were very nice. So we're hoping that it kind of picks up steam along the way. So again, it's a way for us right now in a crazy world to produce content and be creative, but also to engage with our patrons in a way that we're not able to do right now. So we're really thankful for the opportunity, and it's turning out to be a fun experiment in creation.
And it's very convenient for those people who want to view it because, of course, they can do it from the safety of their own home and at the convenience in terms of the time they want to watch. How long will these plays be available?
So our festival technically closes, I'm doing air quotes right now, and closes, December 20th. So again, these plays will release one at a time for every Friday now through November 20th, and then the whole festival will be available still online through the 20th of December, and then at that time, then we'll take all the videos down. So at any point in this festival, somebody could jump in and go, oh, wow, you know, I want to go back and view week one. You would definitely have the opportunity to do that and access to go buy that singly or buy one of our all-access passes that will go on sale again next week.
When I went to fmct.org and checked out what's coming up, there's a cocktail party in a box featuring mm-hmm. Clue. It's a fundraiser. That's later this month. Tell us about that.
Well, so if I describe the 10-minute plays as a hybrid sort of experience, this cocktail party and Clue in particular, this would be a full virtual learning experience. So Clue is rehearsing and performing all online using the Zoom platform. And it's part of a larger evening that is a fundraiser for FMCT, a cocktail party, which we've been holding as a fundraiser for the last 2-3 years at least. And so our cocktail party evening, we will give everything you need to have a fun evening at home by packing up a box full of ingredients for cocktails, and we'll show you how some specialized cocktails, how to mix those up, and we'll have little party games and party favors as part of the package as well, and then the kind of the center event would be this virtual performance of Clue. So we're thinking, for this party in a box, we're thinking a little outside the box right now and trying to, again, make creation happen in a weird time, but also to engage with others that follow FMCT and want to see us succeed.
Well, I missed Girls Night Out, the murder mystery dinner theater that was performed at the Radisson Ballroom back in late September. How did that go?
That went very well as well. So this whole fall, again, to bring back the school metaphor, that would have been a in-person sort of experience. So as we looked at this fall together at FMCT and what our season is, we just knew that, you know, everybody's kind of all over the spectrum in terms of their comfortability right now, what they're willing to do and go out in the public. So the Murder Mystery Dinner Theater went very well for us. We were pleased, although our numbers were a little down from previous years, which is understandable. But that was an in-person experience, and that will be our only in-person production experience that we're planning this fall and into winter. So we're still working on what exactly we're doing for our winter kind of spring season, just kind of letting the world kind of settle and the possibilities present themselves to us. But we're pleased to be able to offer something for everybody right now this fall. And so hopefully people will find a way to be engaged with us.
Well, meanwhile, as you're doing all these various different ways of getting plays in front of people, you're also wrestling with the condition of the actual theater itself. The community theater structure was found to be in some serious difficulty. And that means it has to be fixed. And I know you've got another website, Raise the Roof fmct.org, making the argument about what you'd like to see done. It's a fundraising campaign. You're looking for a total over a number of years, I suspect, of about $12 million to do this stuff. But you make a pretty good case. I went up there, Adam, and I saw that the attendance growth in recent years, in the last 5 years, has been phenomenal. It's up five times. And education enrollment is up as well. So how's the fundraising going?
Well, to be honest, it's a little slower than we'd like it to be right now, but it's not without some gifts that we've received and making progress towards our goal. But that is, you know, thanks for bringing that up, Doug. It's not just about a building that needs to be fixed and these kind of pipe dreams of a facility, of, you know, the best and brightest facility. It really is, considering those attendance figures and considering our education enrollment, just the interest in those programs, it really is about building a facility that can accommodate those numbers and be here and serve our community for decades to come. So it's not about a quick fix about right now. We really are trying to be future-minded in what we're looking to rebuild and renovate and add on to in that facility to continue to serve the Fargo-Moorhead community for generations. So that building is 53 years old and our organization is 74 years old. So we hope to have some of those same longevity, those same numbers moving forward as we put this building back into use. And we're eager for that to happen, believe you me.
Well, I've been going to the FMCT for a very long time, and I've been happy to have been lucky enough to perform in a number of shows there as well. I know the roof repair was the thing that stopped everything cold, but you're looking at making the facility itself just basically better.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that would be our goal. But the first priority, and the project is broken into a few different phases. The first phase of the project is to repair that roof. That's the thing that's keeping us out of that building right now. It is unstable and not a safe place to be, certainly as a full, you know, audience and plays and stuff happening, but also our general operations with our staff and others as well. So the first phase is fix what is broken. And yes, with that comes, you know, some renovation. Since that building is already kind of down for the count right now, it seems to be the best time to put in some of those renovations and some of those safety things in the building and comfort things that we want our patrons to have, rather than shutting ourselves down at another point somewhere down the line to add those sort of things in. So since we're down, we might as well fix it up and fix it up well.
Well, you are an arts organization, a nonprofit arts organization, and one that typically is dealing with audiences, and you've come up with these innovations, if you will, to deal with the pandemic's reality, the fact that people can't really congregate the way they used to. So what is this doing to your bottom line? I know you're always in fundraising mode, but how's the budget been affected by the fact that you haven't had your usual flow of business?
Well, it has an adverse effect on the budget, and we're watching those numbers you know, pretty diligently at this point. So I couldn't quite give you a number, but you know, from March until, you know, this moment here, well, just the spring, actually take that as an example before we kind of got some things back up and going again this summer. We lost five productions in that time frame when we shut down for COVID initially. So lost five productions and a major fundraiser that we would normally do in the spring as well. And so that definitely had a very adverse effect on our budget. That's, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of lost revenue right there. I will say, and I can share this as well, like as an organization, up to this point, even with the building, we were very fiscally sound as an organization. And considering the things that happened with our building and with our, you know, canceling those five productions to end out our fiscal year, which ends on June 30th, we met last season with about 10,000, you know, 10,000 in the red with things. So yes, that's a loss, but I still think again, considering all of the things that happened to us as an organization from December 2019 when the building first went down through the end of our fiscal year, June 30th, we actually feel like we weathered that storm pretty well. You know, this season will be a whole different story, but we're still looking at those bottom lines. Funds are always needed, and thankfully we have had a nice flow of things, but it's still not enough. I know that there will be tough decisions that will need to be made at some point or another, just about keeping us healthy and here for the future.
Well, we do a lot of arts interviews for our show here, and we've been around the state sort of sampling this in Grand Forks and Minot and Bismarck and of course, Fargo. And that is that performance companies have had to learn these new ways to make sure that people know they're still there, which are these like 10-minute plays you're talking about and the other ways that you go online to offer your wares. Could these video outreach pieces become permanent pieces of Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater, for that matter, other theaters too? I mean, is this just a new way and another way to get to an audience?
You know, I've wondered the same thing as well. It is obviously it's not my preferred way of creating, or at least it hasn't endeared itself quite yet to me. But what I see from that possibility is actually in some of the passes that we sold for this 10-minute play festival. A friend of mine who lives in California, he bought a play pass, right? He would have never have been able to come up and see that in person at this point, but he's able to watch these 10-minute plays in Los Angeles, and that's great. I mean, if you're talking about trying to kind of increase your base and just kind of keep evolving as an organization, that maybe these virtual ways are things that organizations should hang on to. It certainly increases an audience base and its outreach, and that's a great thing. So I think even though we are eager to create in the way that we're accustomed to, I don't think that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think we should really look at the things that happened over these few months or years and see what works and what we can continue to do. So I wouldn't be surprised that FMCT maybe keeps some of these efforts up once we get back to whatever our normal will be.
Well, I like you to see theater in person. I love to perform like you do too.
Right.
But now this occurs to me that you've got a statewide audience and for mm-hmm. that matter, an out of state, a California audience, maybe a worldwide audience. And I've been going online a lot to find theater stuff. And I'm finding much more than I expected. So it's out there, and I'm wondering what the residual effect of COVID-19 will be in the kind of performing arts that you and I follow.
I think that's a great question, and I wouldn't be surprised if organizations really take a hard look at what they did to do what they did to just kind of get by right now, if that wouldn't become a part of a permanent season that they curate together to have some sort of virtual online offering every year. So I can certainly say that FMCT will be looking at that as we move forward as well. So it's a great thing.
Adam Panko is the artistic director of the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater. And if you want to find out more about the 10-Minute Play Festival, it's available online, fmct.org, for tickets, and then the link to take you to the shows. Adam, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same to you, Doug. Thanks so much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
What this pandemic has done is shine a light on the fact that we're dangerously dependent on the Chinese Communist Party.
There's a failure in the system. Sheer and utter chaos.
Frontline and the Associated Press investigate America's medical supply crisis.
Watch Frontline, America's medical supply crisis, tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 6th. On this date in 1904, the Hope Pioneer observed that the finest-looking apples in Grand Forks did not come from the famed apple-growing states of Washington or New York. Instead, they came from the local orchard of Oscar Wick, only a mile outside the city. North Dakota has long been known for quality agricultural products from beef to wheat. apples are not usually associated with a state not widely known for growing fruit. The newspaper was confident that Mr. Wick's success with his orchard would change that. Wick sent a shipment of apples to exhibit at the St. Louis World's Fair. He also brought samples to show off in Grand Forks. He grew varieties not widely known today with names like Wealthy and Duchess. The Duchess apples were described as large, perfect in form, beautifully colored, and ripe. He also grew several varieties of crabapple. According to Wick, his success was proof that North Dakota is not too far north to raise fruit. He said that windbreaks were important to protect the fruit, but not in the way most people would think. Instead of needing protection from the cold north winds, the apple trees needed protection from the south. That's because the early spring sun would force sap to flow too soon. The freezing nights were sure to ruin the tree. He also maintained that the strong southerly winds of May would destroy the blossoms before trees could bear fruit. The Carrington Research Extension Center has examined growing apples in North Dakota. The center describes apples as one of the easiest crops and one of the most popular with backyard gardeners. The best trees for the state are full-size tree varieties rather than dwarf trees. Several are suitable for North Dakota. The Hazen grows quickly and bears every year. The Honeycrisp doesn't ripen until October and bears fruit every other year, but the fruit keeps well and stays crisp. Sweet 16 also ripens late. Its fruit has a unique cherry flavor. While apple trees require attention in the form of pruning and mulching, they will reward the careful North Dakota gardener with an ample crop. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
Remote learning challenges almost every family, but few suffer more than those who are homeless.
I was out trying to find a job, even still in the midst of the pandemic on the train. They were complaining, we can't log on, the internet's not working.
How schools are trying to help, and a preview of the vice presidential debate on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, retired North Dakota attorney Mark Schneider has written a novel titled She Has the Right of It. It's a story about growing up Irish Catholic in the Midwest, and it becomes a tale of intrigue when it shifts to Ireland. We'll talk with Schneider about what inspired his book. And Snap Judgment recently debuted on Prairie Public. We'll talk about the show with host Glenn Washington. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.